If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome. My name is Michael Johnston, and this is another episode of New Books in Sociology, a channel on the New Books Network. Today, I have Dr. Wendy Simons with me. She is a professor of sociology, as well as a professor of gerontology and director of graduate studies in gerontology at Georgia State University. Dr. Simon also teaches courses in the specialty area of gender and sexuality and family, health, and life course. Today, we will be talking about Dr. Simon's book, Hospital Land in USA, Sociological Adventures in Medicalization, which was published by Routledge in 2017. Thank you, Wendy, for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
Excellent. So to start, what brought you to this topic, medicine, medical, hospital land? You know, what brought you to this area of research?
So most of my career, I've been doing research that focuses on medical workers. I wrote about mostly reproductive health. And then this book started because of my friendship with Chet Meeks, who was also a sociologist and who was my colleague and friend. Chet died of colon cancer in 2008. He moved to Atlanta a couple of years before to take a job in my department. And soon after he got here, within, I think, 2 months, he was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. He had had a previous experience with colon cancer, but it was removed and he thought he was done with it. And so after he was diagnosed, we spent a lot of time together, and eventually I ended up going with him to most of his chemotherapy appointments. And then he would come home and convalesce at my house. So he became very close with my family and also with a number of other colleagues in our department. And we really did a lot to help him through that period of his life. And so one day I was with Chet at the hospital and He switched during the middle of his treatment. He switched doctors, and we were going to this new hospital that had signs that just really were amazing. On every floor of the hospital, there was a different theme. So the theme might be hope or courage or caring or compassion. And so these words would be really large everywhere, like they were on the floors, on the elevators, on the ceiling. So you might have a sign saying, you know, checkout, and it would have caring above it and another really kind of flowy, italicized sort of font. And so I brought my camera one day because I wanted to take pictures of the signs, but then I started taking pictures of Chet, and I took one when we were sitting in the waiting room and he kind of smiled at me. And then I took one when he was getting his blood pressure taken and he made like a wry face. And so he seemed to be enjoying it. And I love taking photographs. So I kept doing it and I did it for the whole day. And so by the end of the day, I just felt like, wow, that was really a different experience for me anyway. So I sent him an email and I wrote about how different it felt to me and how I felt like both of us felt a sense of power, even though we really didn't have any. But I felt like we kind of felt a sense of power over the experience that we hadn't felt before. And I asked him if he thought we might write something about his experience together. And he liked the idea of it very much. And we did, I think, 4 interviews that I taped. And then when he died, I had no idea what I would do or if I would do anything with the interviews. And it took me a few months to transcribe them. And then I printed them up and put them in a folder with printouts of Chet's blog that he kept for the whole 2 years that he was here, or the almost 2 years that he was going through cancer treatments, and also emails between us and other people who were writing to me about Chet. And I just put all that in a folder, and then I would revisit it periodically and think about it and then put it back away, because it really felt for a long time just too painful. So I did some other smaller kinds of things that I can't even remember what they were now, but I kept coming back to it. And also I kept going into what I call in the book Hospital Land in new ways. And I always would bring my camera because of how much it had helped me when I was together with Chet. And so I think also that I should say that there's another kind of origin story to this book, which is that I had been collecting medical signs before I went with Chet. Beginning in 2001 was the first time that I took a medical sign, and I had gone with my collaborator, Barbara Katz Rothman, to Bellevue, where we were supposed to be doing a focus group interview with medical residents in OBGYN. And we got there and were taken to this empty room where we sat down to wait for them. And the time of the interview came and went. They didn't come. After a while, we went out and checked with a receptionist, and she was sort of puzzled by it. She was the one who had scheduled it for us. And she said, well, they got let out early, and I think they just forgot. So after waiting for like 45 minutes, an hour, I felt like we sort of deserved something. And hanging in that room was a sign that was about, well, I have it, I think, marked here. It's called Bellevue Hospital Center Can't Fail to Satisfy. And it has cartoon figures of doctors and nurses and instructions on how to speak to patients and their families in a way that will be satisfactory. And so I'll just give you an example. The first one shows this little tiny cartoon doctor with outstretched arms and he's saying, hello, my name is dot, dot, dot. I am your nurse aide, et cetera, today. I will be with you until, and then in parentheses, it has 11 p.m. So you know not to always say 11 p.m. I will be checking your blood pressure, helping you to walk, et cetera. And then underneath it says, introducing yourself, explaining what you are going to do and what the patient / family can expect establishes trust and confidence. Patient / family may expect other than what happens, and this is primary source of dissatisfaction. Then in capital letters, this simple phrasing has tremendous impact on satisfaction. And if you think I mispronounced tremendous, I didn't. That's how it's spelled, tremendous. And so the sign goes on, but I took it and I put it in a file folder. And now I have a file folder which has, I think, around 10 or so ads that, well, I shouldn't call them ads, but they are ads for the hospital. Signs that I have liberated from hospital settings when I'm left waiting too long and it doesn't seem like it will be any great loss to take it. So I feel like that is also a beginning of this project, because I was really interested in the graphic representation of medical culture. And so once I started thinking about Chet's story and the photographs and the more photographs that I had taken going into Hospital Land on my own and also accompanying my parents, I wanted to find a way to kind of combine all of this together. And so I feel like what Chet's experience, which I thought at first would be the whole thing I would write about. I kind of envisioned like a biographical book about Chet, became more of an analysis of medicalized culture that uses Chet's experience as a starting point.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I found most fascinating about this book is the battery of methods that you use to research this hospital land, not only using raw stories of patients in the hospital. I believe it was Chet, as well as your father, who was also part of this
father,
book?
Yeah, my father, after Chet died, it wasn't too much longer till my father had a stroke. And it was, well, you know, let me rephrase that. Several years later, my father had a stroke, and then he lived for almost 2 years after his stroke. And in my view, he should have probably died when he had the stroke. So that was another impetus that really made me want to kind of look at this experience of being medicalized across the life course, and also to think about like the ways in which we die, you know, and how much this is not the way that most of us want to die. We don't really want to die medicalized deaths where we have a lot of futile treatment and suffering and or loss of our capabilities. So much so in my father's case that he really was not like himself. He was like a toddlerized version of himself. So that was a motivating factor. I feel like I was so angry about his experience that kind of renewed my all the emotions that I had felt when I had gone through chemotherapy with Chet. And I felt like I could pull this together and also look at cultural representations of medicalization too. So I feel like the book is part autobiographical, it's part ethnographic, and it's part discourse analysis.
Yes, and that's the third piece that I was going to mention, which is the symbolic meaning that is associated with the signs that are put up and are representative of the impersonal rationalization of the hospital, creating patterned behavior with that while also depersonalizing clients from their patients, doctors and nurses from their patients, which you also mentioned in there about how you normally wouldn't use the word patients, but in this case, patients is a proper term to use throughout this book. So what is this hospital land? Is it a microcosm of the larger world? Is it something that's set apart from the world? What do you see hospital land as being?
Well, in the book, I use the term hospital land to refer to medicalized environments in general. So all medical facilities, outpatient centers, therapy centers, imaging centers, residential care facilities, doctor's offices, clinics, rehab centers, nursing homes, and some hospices. Hospital land, though, is more than just physical space. I think it involves also the activities that we do when we are trying to arrange going there and getting there and being there. And I feel like it spills out of its institutions into our lives in so many ways in terms of just like medical propaganda that never stops. You know, you turn on the television, you see medical ads, you go, especially on trips, I notice in airports and subway stations have a lot of medical ads. And then one of the things that I also write about in the book is medical mail, which I think if you're not old enough to get it, you will be one day, and it kind of adjusts as you age. And I feel like once you start looking for evidence of hospital land, you will never stop finding it. And that's really how it was for me. I also use the term hospital land, ironically, to kind of conjure up a warped amusement park, because I feel like in so many ways, that's what it is like. But it's not frivolous, right? I mean, you'll find very little frivolity in hospital land that isn't false or infantilizing. And I do talk about the ways that a lot of the signs that you see are very infantilizing. And then medicalization is the other definition that I use in the book. So it's not really too theoretically difficult to read. But so I brought in Peter Conrad's definition of medicalization as, quote, a process by which non-medical problems become defined and treated as medical problems. I broaden it out and define medicalization as the dynamic set of processes by which medical authorities, institutions, and ideologies come to organize and reorganize, define and redefine, structure and restructure our everyday experiences, culture, and social life. So to be medicalized means to submit to medical authorities and also to understand our bodies, our minds, ourselves through medical lenses. And I think we all do this in so many ways, and we're encouraged to do it because our culture thinks this way. I mean, I feel like this is really one of the dominant discourses in our culture.
And then as a result of that, we maybe in some ways it's become a medical industrial complex. It's the way that I see this, and please let me know if I'm wrong, but medicine is becoming a primary part of everyday life and being less about the person and more about profit that is associated with medicine, medicine that is done through prescription, but also done through medicalizing almost any problem that a person, any ailment that a person might have.
Totally, totally. And I think also that medical industrial complex refers to the connections between hospital land and other institutions like the government and the military and in this country, capitalism. So yeah, I think the medical industrial complex makes sense as well. As it's like another way of saying hospital land.
And in your book, and this is a good time to get into the stories, because the stories, I think is one of the most important parts of this book. It really brings the book to life through the stories that are told about Chet, as well as others, and the experiences that you had while attending the hospital. A couple different types that you mentioned here are childhood adventures, adventures with your sister, nighttime adventures, and adventures with the camera. Could you tell me about this? The significance of these stories and how you use them to make sense of everyday life?
Well, I think as sociologists, at least as qualitative researchers, we focus on stories, right? And I feel like stories can get across theoretical concepts or kind of larger ideas in ways that resonate with people a lot. And that's one of the things that has been most pleasing to me about this book is how much people say it resonates with them. If my experience aren't like theirs, then it encourages them to think about their own experiences. And I think it's very hard to not have these kinds of stories. We just don't really think about them too much. I think a lot of times we maybe even try to put them out of our minds. And yeah, I think the book is full of stories. So there are stories that Chet tells because I quote from his blog. And then there's me telling Chet's overall story. And then there are stories I tell about my own adventures or what I call an alternative medical history. Because I think so often we think about just like, oh, well, you know, I had an eye exam and I got new glasses. We don't think about the part of what it feels like to be in a dark room with a man you don't know. You know, like the whole, all the aspects, the emotional aspects or the experiential aspects of it that really aren't part of what we call our medical history. So I tell a lot of those. And I really had to sift through them because, of course, there are a lot more ones than the ones that are in the book. So I tried to pick ones that would illustrate the kinds of themes that I feel like are most prevalent there. You know, how tedious it is, how disorienting it is, how sometimes even, you know, we can't trust the memories that we have there because could that really have happened? Strange things happen in the night and strange things happen when we're drugged and strange things happen when we watch people who we love go through really hard medical experiences and we don't have any power over it. So I kind of wanted to show the range of a variety of different experiences in the chapter that comes after the one that focuses on Chet. And And I also wanted to kind of lighten it a bit. I wanted the book to not just be hard and traumatic kinds of recounts of bad hospital and experiences, because it is so much more than that. And so then there are also the stories that I analyze in the chapter that I have that's about cultural representations. So I look at stories in actual books that tell stories that are memoirs by hospital land workers or by people who themselves have spent time there, so sufferers or accompanists. And I also look at the kinds of stories that come through the ads that we see everywhere in the mail that we get. What are the stories that get told by medical ads? And this is something that when I teach qualitative methods is I find a bunch of medical ads and put them up around the room and we do various kinds of coding on them to kind of look for what's in there and what we see in these ads. And so much of it is really about what I call a disease disaster narrative, where we think about, you know, think about any kind of disease disaster movie you might have seen. Contagion's my favorite one, and I'm really saying favorite in scare quotes because I don't like this genre. I don't like the kind of total chaos that always seems to ensue. So I write about the tropes that go on in this, you know, disease disaster narrative. And the book came out in 2017, right? And then I was doing talks on it for several years after my last talks that I gave. I think I told you this before the interview started, were in February 2020. So we were just on the brink of being part of a pandemic, right? It was coming our way. And a lot of the kinds of tropes that I write about in the book were already happening, like medicine and government were conflicting. All kinds of stories were going around about what it was. Xenophobia and racism had already gotten ramped up by the fear of this, you know, invader from without. It's very strange, I feel like, to have written about this as a trope and then have to live through it, right? We're still living through it afterwards. It's just weird. When I went on that trip to give those talks, I also went to the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia and saw an exhibit about the plague. And I just thought, wow, are we on the verge of something like this that will be in an exhibit one day? No doubt, right? If our species survives.
And then even the insincerity of NFL and NBA and other entertainment industries drawing from COVID-19 to help, you know, pad their stats. That was quite interesting. And I think that adds to this medical industrial complex that you mentioned earlier.
Right. I went on a walk the other night and the only vehicles I saw were Amazon delivery vans. And I thought, this is just like a disease disaster movie. Like this is where we are now. It's very strange.
Now, I mentioned how derogatory the concept patient can be. However, the first wave feminist movement pointed out that using the concept of patient can be offensive. But in your book, you say that it's intentional to use patient. You want that offense to be loudly presented based on the experiences that you want that to be loudly given the experience that you had while at the hospital, but also with some of these different signs that you saw. Where did this offensiveness of the concept patient come from? And then what is your strategy, or what is your reason? I guess maybe it wasn't even strategy, but reason for using such a concept as patient in your book.
Well, I mainly use it because that's a term that's used when you're there, right? No one gets called a client unless they're going to a feminist clinic, right? And client is also a little bit it's not the most satisfying word. So the discontent with patient was, I think, the hierarchical relationship that it conveys. It's rooted in the Latin for suffering or enduring or waiting, right? And to me, I feel like this is pretty apt in hospital land. I want to say that also client, which is was picked up, I think, because it seemed more neutral and less hierarchical, also has dissatisfying etymological roots in the Latin for hear or obey, and also in denotes a protected status. So there's a little bit of it there too. I mean, client sounds like a business term, right? I mean, years later, I feel like I don't know what other term I'd suggest, but client, I use patient because that's the common phrasing there. And I feel like it really does encompass what it's like to be in hospital land while you're waiting and suffering.
Yes. And I can see that power dynamics associated with both client and also with patient, and this unequal power between a doctor or a nurse and the client or patient. But I think something that rang true throughout your book is some of the experiences of disembodiment that might take place while at the hospital, and the objectification of the person, removing the body from their personhood.
Right. And we consent to it, right? I mean, that's one of the things that I think is most ironic, is that in most other cases where you have your consciousness, you know, messed with, you aren't really capable of consent. And here we consent before we're drugged, to being drugged and being intervened with in a wide variety of ways, you know, cut open, cut apart, etc.
Or even I think there's an age-old sociological study that was published, but about, you know, the dramaturgical experience that took place in the gynecological exam room, and integrated as a professional scene by having the drape over the between the upper body and lower body to make it a professional experience. The same could be true in terms of a male physical and the expectation for the man to turn his head and cough. Well, is it more about not facing the person who is getting ready to carry out these actions, or is it medically tied? And I think the turning of the head would be more to depersonalize that experience so that the relationship can maintain professionalism.
Exactly. There's a lot of depersonalization in the name of professionalization in hospital land, for sure.
So you also point out that healthcare is not what is being necessarily provided by hospitals, rather that it's services that are being carried out. How so?
So yeah, I really got this from my mentor, Barbara Katz Rothman, who pointed out to me that the term healthcare rarely like applies, because so often it's not healthy and so often it's not caring. And so instead I try to talk about the provision of medical services. And I'm not trying to say that means that you never get healthful care, but I don't think that is a norm. That is not what medicine is organized around.
And then just probably to give time and conversation where it is due in this book and where our conversation began, I want to close out with this blog that Chet wrote. And about how he was placed in a medical category, him not only being the one placed in a medical category, your father, I think, also would have been considered to be placed in a medical category. What does that mean?
Well, I think it's a combination of diagnosis and prognosis, right? In the case that I write about, where Chet complained about the category he was placed in, he felt that he had been deemed a lost cause by his doctor. And so I'll read you what he wrote about it. This is from November 3rd, 2006. He blogged, "I want to ask my doctor a bunch of questions, mostly because I can tell that he doesn't like it when I ask questions. I do not like my current oncologist that much. He talks too much, doesn't listen well, and I can tell already that he has put me in a medical category and isn't doing a lot of active thinking about my disease. I want a doctor who goes to bed at night and wakes up in the morning thinking about colon cancer." And so a few months after he wrote this, his doctor, whom I call Dr. Penultimate or Dr. P in the book, told Chet that a PET scan showed that he was cancer-free. And Chet was so excited about this. But he also resented that Dr. P seemed to be taking credit for this success that turned out to not really be a success. He felt like it was his body that had done all the work of dealing with the chemo drugs. And in any case, it really did get his hopes up. And it was really a fake kind of cancer-freeness.
And this medical category that Chet talks about is, I think, something that bothered him, or at least that's the sense that I got from it, particularly because, you know, he wanted the doctor to be a professional, somebody who wakes up and goes to sleep and thinks about it. Since, after all, I think throughout the whole process, Chet also became a professional of his cancer. He spent hours on end researching the cancer that he had, almost knowing just as much, if not more, because he would bring up state-of-the-art practices and asking the doctor if those would be fitting for his cancer. Is that accurate?
Yeah, and I think that Chet was really in a conflicted position. And at first, I feel like when I was thinking about it to write about it, I thought for a while that Chet was just too compliant sometimes, you know, and too nice about how he felt. I remember once after several months of just waiting for him, I asked if I could go with him to the exam room, and he let me come. And I remember, you know, the nurse greeted him, "How are you doing, Mr. Meeks?" And he's like, "Oh, I'm doing good." And he was not doing good. And then the doctor came in, and this is the doctor I called Dr. Last. And he said, "How are you doing, Mr. Meeks?" And he said, "Oh, I'm doing all right." And I was just sitting there thinking, "No, you're not." You know, I felt like he was minimizing how shitty all the drugs were making him feel. And then I felt like, after further reflection, that he was doing this to sort of present the willingness to get the whatever was coming next to engage in the fight. You know, he was really into the fight of it. And I really dislike these kinds of militaristic metaphors for really anything. It's hard to get away from them. They're so common in our culture. But he wanted to do whatever he was going to do to fight, to win. And so he wanted to present himself, I think, as compliant so that he could continue with the treatments. And he did really continue with the treatments almost till the end of his life. Really, he decided to stop chemo just a few weeks before he died. And I think he just couldn't, he got where he was so worn down. I remember that having a conversation with him where he, because he at one point designated me as the point person for people who had questions to call and ask about his condition and his treatment. And I said, "Well, what do you want me to tell them? Like, do you want me to give them all the details?" And he's like, "Well, I don't know. I don't want people to think that I've given up and stopped fighting." And I said to him, "You know, at some point I feel like you have to stop seeing this as giving up. It's giving in, right? There's nothing you can do about it. You don't have the power to fight." But yeah, I think that he was willing to try anything. And it was really his mother who told him she wanted him to stop the treatment that gave him permission, I think, to finally just say, "Okay, enough."
Yeah, so a consequence that I'm hearing that may be associated with being put into a medical category is the potential of having doctors, having medical staff just give up on you. However, the alternative is to resist such a medical category, which depending on you know, whether it's fighting the good fight, may also not be the greatest of options either, as a result of putting oneself through a series of procedures that aren't most kind on the body.
Right. And I think you don't always know. I think in a lot of cases with this sort of treatment, you don't know whether it's going to help or how bad the treatment itself will be before you start. And, you know, Chet had hope, but obviously he was also fed hope that, in my view, was false hope. And I think that's a very common aspect of medical treatment, because for so many medical practitioners, death is a failure to them. Not saving someone is a failure to them. And I feel like it's the great doctors who really look at this critically and recognize that that's not always possible and that can't always be the goal.
Yeah, you know, I wonder where hospice comes into this, because I think that was the maybe intent of hospice emerging, to be able to allow a person to die with dignity.
Right, and that's where I see it as most active in hospice and also in the palliative care specialty. And I feel like one of the things that we really need is for palliative care to be integrated much more effectively with the other specializations that will deal with other specializations of medical practitioners who deal with people when they're facing end-of-life issues. I feel like right now, the way things work, people don't get to hospice till very close to the end. The average amount of time that people spend on hospice is 3 weeks. And you can be you're supposed to be certified, medically certified, that you're going to die within 6 months. And that can be extended. But 3 weeks is a lot shorter than 6 months. So that means it takes a long time for that to ever get on the table. Chet was on hospice. Chet was put on hospice when he stopped his chemotherapy. And like I said, you know, he died within a few weeks and the hospice services had just begun. Like, I don't even know if a visit had been made aside from the pre-visit.
And then just the ungodly costs that are associated with hospice, making it inaccessible for some and requiring some to others to wait until the final minutes, the final days of a person leading up to their death, because otherwise it would be a taxing, it'd be burdensome on potentially the family or others to make up for that cost.
Right. And if there aren't that many in-person hospice centers, so most of the care is expected to be done by family members or friends at home, not everybody can really set that up in their lives. So a lot of people, I feel like, are underserved. A lot of people are underserved.
Well, this was a great joy to, you know, a great opportunity to be able to read this book and to be able to talk with you more about it, to get greater insight in the stories that were told by Chet and by your father and the experiences that you had while attending the hospital, for both their care, but also for other experiences that you had in the hospital for your profession, right? Going and meeting with, or trying to meet with nurses, I guess I should say, in training. But, one final question that I have that I'm starting to know is, where's your research going now? This was 2017, but is this research done and over with, or do you see it still having open doors to continue the research on still yet today?
Well, my research has really moved in a new direction right now. I've been doing some research on advice to older adults about sexuality. And this ties in with previous work that I've done. I co-edited a sexuality reader that called Sex Matters. And as I've moved more and more of my academic life into gerontology, I'm interested in kind of exploring the other end of life. Previously, I was looking at reproductive issues. So I've kind of shifted focus, but not exactly. I had some fantasy after the book came out that I would expand it and like be like hospital land world, but that's not happening in a pandemic, right? But I remain interested and I continue to collect signs, mostly by photographing them, and update my talks on hospital land so that they're current with all the new horrors that have been happening in the past few years. So I remain interested for sure, but I'm doing something a little different now.
You beat me to the question. You know, I was going to ask you if you're still taking signs, but you're taking the pictures of these signs because there's plenty of information out there in terms of signage and ads and mail, even for adult sex education resources, commercials. I all of a sudden I'm getting that in my head of the commercials that are out there, and it's rich. All you have to do is turn the television on, and there's probably something about Cialis.
Right. I mean, we all know kind of what those ads look like and how they stress this notion that to age healthfully means that you will be sexual your whole life. And if you have issues with conventional, heteronormative, penile penetrative sex, then here's a drug for you. Yeah.
Well, this is going to be a great book once it's written, and I hope that I can I hope that you will accept my invite to be on the show again for your next book.
Thank you so much.
Excellent. Again, this has been another episode of New Books in Sociology. I am Michael Johnston, your host, and thank you again, Wendy, for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure.